This is a reading from Genesis chapter 12. It's the start of the Abraham stories that will go on for chapter and verse after chapter and verse. Abraham, who was first called Abram, is considered to be the father of not one but three closely related religious traditions: Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Since our religious movement is an offshoot of the Christian branch of this family tree, we might ask if this means that he is the founder of our tradition as well, if our way is an Abrahamic way of living in faith. But what does this mean? What can we observe about the Abrahamic way that distinguishes it among other religious ways? It will take some looking. Tradition presents Abraham to us through a cycle of stories, not a list of principles. Why not begin with the first story and see if it leads to some principles along the way, okay? Let's get going. Now the Lord said to Abram, "Go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you, and I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and him who curses you I will curse, and by you all the families of the earth shall bless themselves." So Abram went, as the Lord had told him, and Lot went with him. Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran. Now that's in Mesopotamia, somewhere probably in modern-day Iraq. When he departed from Haran, and Abram took Sarai, his wife, and Lot, his brother's son, and all their possessions which they had gathered, and the persons that they had gotten in Haran. And they set forth to go to the land of Canaan. When they had come to the land of Canaan, Abram passed through the land to the place at Shechem, to the oak of Moreh. At that time, the Canaanites were in the land. Then the Lord appeared to Abram and said, "To your descendants I will give this land." So he built there an altar to the Lord who had appeared to him. Now the Lord said to Abram, "Go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you." So the first thing God says to Abraham is go. The Hebrew says lech lecha, more like get yourself going. In fact, this chapter is not called Genesis 12 in the Hebrew Bible. It's called Get Going. And it starts with God telling Abraham what he should get going away from. First, go from your country, the physical surroundings where you've had your livelihood. Second, leave your molad, which is a word for your mother's relatives. Third, leave your father's house. House being understood to mean your father's family as much as any bricks or mortar. In other words, I'm not telling you just to go. You have to leave all of this behind. The astounding thing is that Abraham does it. But how does he know that it's God who's telling him to do so? We don't know if he and God have ever been introduced before. We never heard of that. Maybe he was already itching to get going. We don't know which comes first, his readiness to go or this call by God to do so. Maybe the readiness invites the call, or the call just reveals the readiness. Remember, this is a story, not a system. God says go, Abraham goes. There's a simplicity and directness here that's truly remarkable in more ways than one. Most religions of the ancient world seem to have been preoccupied with maintaining social, political, agricultural, and cosmic patterns with as little change as possible, keeping people and gods and things in place. But here's something different. At the first moment of a new faith tradition, it's the first moment, it's sort of like a religious big bang. You hear, go. Everyone's beeping today. All right, now everything stop beeping, please. Dad has spoken. This is Father's Day. Dad's in no mood for that. Go. Put a distance between yourself, where you come from, and who you were before. Other faith traditions work hard to maintain continuity, but the Abrahamic one works just as hard to set up change and movement. Place of birth, mother's kin, father's house, leave them all and go. Pull up those anchors. So Abrahamic religious experience must include a willingness to be a stranger, at least for a time, on the way to becoming a new person. Have you ever had that experience? Have you ever been the only American in a crowd, or the only person of a certain complexion, the only one who doesn't speak the language, doesn't know the currency or the customs, how to eat at the what's at the table, or even what it is? Sometimes you just want to curl up and cry. I know. It's not always easy. But would you say, if it's happened, would you say that was a valuable experience for you? Isolated from our usual supports, our usual reference points, our familiar hamster trails, we discover new things, new resources, both inside and out. We surprise ourselves, maybe, by how much we can handle, or by how little we may need those things that seemed so essential back at home among our kin. But please notice that when Abram gets going, he doesn't go alone. And Abram took Sarai, his wife, and Lot, his brother's son, and all their possessions which they had gathered, and the persons they had gotten in Haran, and they set forth to go to the land of Canaan, or Canaan. God's call to Abram has an immediate effect on his family, on his nephew's family, and on all the people in their households, relatives and servants. We don't know if God has said anything yet to them, or if they just trust Abram implicitly. But it's not only his family who we need to consider. The narrator adds that at that time, the Canaanites were in the land. Then the Lord appeared to Abram and said, "To your descendants I will give this land." You see the problem? So he built there an altar to the Lord who had appeared to him. God claims the land for Abram's descendants, and Abram stakes that claim by building an altar on the Canaanites' land, who, the story pauses to tell us, happened to still be there. Well, the altar existed for many, many centuries before the pulpit did. All over the world, that's where ancient religious activity really happened, where the animals were killed, cut up, put into the fire. So it's not like wheeling my portable grill to your front door and saying, "Let's do some ribs." It's more like me coming and building my brick barbecue in your backyard for a meal to which you aren't invited. Abram got going when God called, but clearly this thing that Abram and God have got going is going to affect a lot of people. Abram gets going at the age of 75. His wife Sarai is not much younger, but as yet they have no children. Without them, without children, how can their descendants become a multitude that'll swarm the Canaanites' land so that they can party around Dad's barbecue? So when both are over 80, seeing this problem, Sarai offers to let Abram father a child with her Egyptian maid Hagar. We don't know if Hagar was consulted, but soon she's pregnant. And surprise, Sarai is jealous. Hagar is driven out into the wilderness. God provides for her and promises her son Ishmael his own multitude in still somebody else's land. The consequences of God's dealings with Abram are ripping out now in all directions, like from a rock thrown in a pond or in that creek where the boy and the man did their painting and frog catching. Well, then, when Abram is 99 and Sarai 90, God appears again and promises that within a year they will have a natural child of their own. Is there anyone here who's 90 and feels like having a child this year? I My mind is taking me back to Holland, where there are all these joke stores and gag stores, and there are all kinds of cards about Abraham and Sarah. And I'm remembering some of those silly cards. I have to wipe that out of my mind. Well, God appears and promises they'll have this natural child of their own without the assistance of the foreign-born domestic help. So he changes Abram's name to Abraham, father of a multitude, and Sarai's to Sarah, or princess. Now both laugh at the thought of having a son at their age. So when he's born, their son is called Yitzhak, or Isaac, which means he laughed. You can only imagine how this old couple would have felt about this boy, born so late in life to parents old enough to be his grandparents, great-grandparents, or great-great-grandparents. It must be like love to the fourth power. At least. Isaac is the treasure of treasures, which brings us to a story that's central to the faith of Jews, Christians, and Muslims alike. The story that defines this common faith, if anything does. It's been the subject of countless anonymous stained glass windows, frescoes, and icons, and of masterpieces by the great masters of Western art, Donatello, Caravaggio, Rembrandt, and Marc Chagall. Stravinsky, Benjamin Britten, Bob Dylan, and Joan Baez have all set it to music. The Bible doesn't tell us how old Isaac is when the story takes place. Some of these artists imagine him as a small boy, others as a teen or even a young adult. But Abram is over 100 when we hear that, I'll get my Bible voice on again, God tested Abraham and said to him, Abraham, and he said, here I am. He said, take your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering upon one of the mountains of which I shall tell you. The perfect spot, I guess. So Abraham rose early in the morning, saddled his ass, and took two of his young men with him and his son Isaac, and he cut the wood for the burnt offering and arose and went to the place of which God had told him. On the third day, Abraham lifted up his eyes and saw the place from afar. Then Abraham said to his young men, stay here with the ass. I and the lad will go yonder and worship and come again to you. The first part of the story gives us the motive, a test, and also the setting and the cast of characters. God, Abraham, Isaac, an ass, and two young men, probably servants, or who else would they be? It also starts a timeline or a countdown. There's a first day, a night's sleep, if anybody could sleep, a second day from dawn through another night, then the third day, the day of sacrifice. And Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on Isaac his son, and he took in his hand the fire and the knife. So they went, both of them together, and Isaac said to his father, Abraham, my father. And he said, here am I, my son. He said, here are the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for a burnt offering? Abraham said, God will provide the lamb for a burnt offering, my son. So they went, both of them together. When they came to the place of which God had told him, Abraham built an altar there and laid the wood in order and bound Isaac his son and laid him upon the altar, upon the wood. Now we hear people complain about the Bible's long genealogies dragging on and lists of who lived how many years, but it shows its real power as a book set in days. On the first day this, on the second day that. A day of action. A day of rest. Now see how the story of Abraham and Isaac moves day by day, then step by step up the mountain, compressing time into minutes, then seconds, and finally into one heart-pounding instant. Then Abraham put forth his hand and took the knife to slay his son. But the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. And he said, here I am. He said, do not lay your hand on the lad or do anything to him, for now I know that you fear God, seeing you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. And Abraham lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, behind him was a ram caught in a thicket by its horns. And Abraham went and took the ram and offered it up as a burnt offering instead of his son. So I want to pause now for a moment on Father's Day to honor all of those who did not escape, who did not escape being sacrificed by one or both parents on the altar of the God they served. Maybe it was the bottle, or the dollar, or always being right. Maybe you didn't escape, but you survived, and I'm glad you're here today. And I want to say, parents, if it comes to this, it's better that you sacrifice your God or your altar than your child.
Amen.
This is a very, very difficult story. Thousands and thousands of pages have been written about it, but no effort to derive a single meaning has ever been successful. One thing is clear. It shows us again how the religious faith of one has consequences for others. Sometimes these others are strangers who do not share our language, customs, or beliefs. Sometimes they're the people closest to us, our friends and our families. The question still remains, what, if anything, makes our faith tradition an Abrahamic one? Who in this story should be a model for our own lives? Abraham? Sarah? Hagar? Isaac? I suppose we could be like the ass and simply bear this story like a religious burden with no idea about what we should do with it except what we're told. Just believe it and don't ask questions. When the halter is pulled, you go. When it's tied, you stop and don't move anymore except to swat flies with your tail. But this doesn't sound like any way that I would want to do religion. Maybe it's appropriate for livestock, for some dumbass of a believer, but not for folks like you or me. Does the story offer us any other choices or any other models? Remember the cast of characters? How about those two young men who Abraham has brought on the journey? Why bring them along? And why two and not one? A single witness might have sat in silence while the old man and his son went up to the mountain to have their secret barbecue. Maybe if it was you, you could talk to the ass a little bit to ease the anxiety, though the ass won't say much in reply, and you won't hear from any talking ass until I give my next sermon. Wait, that didn't come out right. You'll understand, though, in 2 weeks when you hear it. But for now, let's get back to the story at hand. We have two young people, not one. Two young folks will talk and joke and wonder out loud together. What do you think they're doing on the mountain? Why all the firewood? Why not let the ass carry it for them, or maybe one of us? Did you see the knife? What are they doing? What's taking them so long? Do you think they're coming back? Well, here is a story that sets us to wondering. Sets us to wondering, and has done so for thousands of years. And that may be the real point of it, to set us to wondering together. The young folks in the story, that's us. That's you and me, sitting together for a time on the edge of things, pondering it all, the natural world around us, the mountains, the stream, plains, and the sky, the mystery of human actions and choices. The voices that we hear calling us from beyond or think that we hear, wondering what there is to hold on to and what we must let go. What will be the consequences of the old man's faith for his son? For someone just like us. What will be the consequences of my faith for others, including and maybe even especially for those who do not share it? Is there any way to know? At the very least, what do I hope for those consequences to be? What do I wish and dream and pray for others and not just for myself? Well, if our own faith tradition is an Abrahamic one, then how do we answer these questions? What impact will our religious lives have upon the lives of our neighbors? Because they will. Make no mistake about it. They must. So what do we hope those consequences will be? Well, you may have noticed 7 possibilities that are offered up on the back of your order of service. I might have drawn your attention to these once or twice in the past. I've completely missed mine, so you have yours. That's good enough. The first one is like a key to all the others, to affirm and promote the inherent worth and dignity of every person, which gets us going towards justice, equity, and compassion in human relations, and then leads all the way to respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part, and of which Jen spoke beautifully last night at our Forum on Science and Religion. You can take this program with you when you go, or you can recycle it if you choose. But please look at it again before you sacrifice it to the bin. As sure as Abraham bound Isaac, my faith is bound to have consequences on the lives of others. I hope that I can be a part of the story of such great affirmations as these. I hope that I can nudge the world in this direction, at least a little. How about you? We have a long way to go. So let's take a deep breath and let's get going. Amen.